In the early days of 2009, as Barack Obama's inauguration unfolded in Washington, D.C., two groups of entrepreneurs on opposite coasts were about to change how we travel forever. Little did they know their startups would become the fastest-growing companies in history, transforming entire industries while battling entrenched interests at every turn. The Upstarts by Brad Stone chronicles the meteoric rise of Uber and Airbnb, companies that redefine transportation and hospitality without owning a single car or hotel room. The book has become required reading in business schools worldwide and counts Richard Branson, Elon Musk, and Sheryl Sandberg among its admirers. Its cultural impact extends beyond business circles. The term Uber for X has become shorthand for any on-demand service, while Airbnb-ing has entered the lexicon as a verb. What makes this story particularly fascinating is how these companies didn't just build better mousetraps, they reimagined entire industries by leveraging smartphones, social networks, and our willingness to trust strangers through digital reputation systems. When Brian Chesky moved to San Francisco in 2007, he was taking an enormous risk, inspired by his hero Walt Disney's own relocation to Hollywood decades earlier. Broke and desperate, Chesky and his roommate Joe Gebbia turned their apartment into a makeshift designer's bed and breakfast during a design conference when all hotels were booked. This improvised solution, complete with air mattresses and homemade breakfast, became the seed for Airbnb. The early days were marked by constant struggle. Despite recruiting Nathan Bletcherchick, a Harvard-educated programming prodigy, the company faced relentless rejection. Investors couldn't comprehend why anyone would want to stay in a stranger's home. "People are actually doing this? Why? What's wrong with them?" was venture capitalist Paul Graham's initial reaction. When the 2008 financial crisis hit, the founders reached their trough of sorrow, that painful period when a startup's novelty wears off and reality sets in. With credit cards maxed out and no investment in sight, they made a desperate, creative pivot, selling politically themed breakfast cereals. Obama O's and Captain McCain's were limited edition boxes they designed, produced, and sold for $40 each. The stunt generated enough media attention and sales to keep them afloat, though they survived primarily by eating leftover cereal. This resilience impressed Y Combinator's Paul Graham, who called them cockroaches, his highest compliment for founders who simply refused to die. When Sequoia Capital's Greg McAdding later asked Graham which Y Combinator founders were mentally toughest, Graham pointed directly at the Airbnb team. This quality, persistence in the face of overwhelming odds, would prove crucial as they faced regulatory battles that made early investor rejections seem trivial by comparison. While Airbnb's founders were selling cereal to survive, Garrett Camp was developing what would become Uber after experiencing frustration with San Francisco's taxi system. Camp, who had sold StumbleUpon to eBay for $75 million, recruited his friend Travis Kalanick to help bring his vision of everyone's private driver to life. The initial development team was remarkably scrappy. Oscar Salazar enlisted his friends from Colima, Mexico, Jose Uribe and Zoma Rodriguez, to build the first dispatch system from Uribe's childhood bedroom. When they requested cash payment, Salazar convinced them to take equity instead, stakes now worth millions. "I try not to think about that," Uribe later admitted with understandable regret. The first version used SMS for ride requests, but address errors made this problematic. After Camp sent Salazar a Wired magazine featuring GPS apps, they pivoted to developing an iPhone version with Dutch designer Gel Prince. By fall 2009, they had a working prototype that allowed users to watch cars move across a map in real time, a moment one early user compared to watching James Bond's tracking system in Casino Royale. Neither Camp nor Kalanick initially wanted to run Uber full-time. Kalanick's famous tweet seeking an entrepreneurial product manager slash biz dev killer led to Ryan Graves responding with what became the single most lucrative tweet in internet history. Graves became Uber's first CEO, while his wife remained in Chicago, and the team set up in a borrowed conference room across from the Transamerica Pyramid. Most top Silicon Valley investors passed on Uber's seed round, failing to see its potential with just 10 drivers and 10 rides per weekend. First-round capital led with $600,000, followed by Chris Sacca's $300,000 investment after a sushi dinner. Naval Ravikant of AngelList, who helped connect Uber with investors, only managed to invest $25,000, a position later worth over $100 million. You have to make peace with the fact that Silicon Valley is so random, Ravikant reflected, or else you'll never get a good night's sleep in this town. The success of Uber and Airbnb seems inevitable in retrospect, but several earlier companies attempted similar concepts and failed. Their stories reveal how timing, execution, and vision separate successful disruptors from forgotten pioneers. Couchsurfing, founded in 2004 by Casey Fenton, predated Airbnb by 5 years. Unlike Airbnb's marketplace approach, Couchsurfing operated as a nonprofit connecting travelers with hosts offering free accommodations. Fenton infused the company with idealistic notions, pitching it as a way to make meaningful connections rather than a transactional service. The organization operated chaotically, no real office, hundreds of nomadic volunteers, and founders working from different locations. By 2008, they had a few dozen paid employees and over 2,000 volunteers scattered across time zones, resulting in an outdated, difficult-to-use website. When New Hampshire informed them they were improperly registered as a nonprofit, the founders disagreed on next steps. Hoffer, now a business school graduate, pushed to become for-profit and charge per stay. Fenton adamantly refused, believing money would dilute the purity of the experience. Meanwhile, Airbnb's founders met with Hoffer for pizza in 2008, asking pointed questions about building trust between strangers. Hoffer sensed the threat, but prioritized loyalty to his co-founders over pursuing a relationship with Airbnb, a choice which probably cost me $1 billion, he later reflected. Similarly, Zimride, founded by Logan Green and John Zimmer, focused on filling empty car seats for long trips between cities. Despite raising $7.2 million in venture funding, they struggled to scale beyond university campuses. The founders realized their carpooling service was only used occasionally and merely replaced bulletin boards rather than transforming transportation. In early 2012, inspired by Uber's success, they pivoted to a new concept allowing people to share vehicles for short trips within cities, rebranding as Lyft and decorating cars with pink mustaches to make them appear friendlier. These stories illustrate that being first isn't enough. Successful disruption requires the right model, timing, and execution. Couchsurfing's idealistic nonprofit approach couldn't compete with Airbnb's frictionless marketplace, while Zimride needed to pivot dramatically to become relevant in the emerging ride-sharing economy. Nathan Bletcherchik, Airbnb's technical co-founder, had built a lucrative spam software business in his teens, earning nearly $1 million before college. His business provided tools for email marketers to disguise their campaigns through foreign relays. Though he shut it down in 2002 to focus on Harvard studies, this early venture revealed his talent as a growth hacker, someone who uses technical skills to drive product adoption. This background proved invaluable for Airbnb after Y Combinator. The company deployed two controversial tactics to overcome Craigslist's massive user advantage. First, they created a system sending automated emails to Craigslist property listers, using female-named Gmail accounts to encourage them to list on Airbnb instead. When exposed by blogger Dave Gooden, Airbnb claimed contractors were responsible. Their second, more effective strategy was creating a tool allowing Airbnb users to cross-post their listings to Craigslist with a single click. This elegant technical hack inserted visually superior Airbnb listings into Craigslist's ecosystem, effectively siphoning users to their platform. Bletcherchik also pioneered targeted Facebook ads that matched listing opportunities to users' interests. Rent your room to a yogi. By fall 2010, Airbnb was thriving with 700,000 nights booked across 8,000 cities. The company formalized its leadership structure with Chesky as CEO, moved into a proper office, and raised new funding from Sequoia and Greylock's Reid Hoffman. Many venture capitalists passed, including Marc Andreessen and Howard Hartenbaum, who later regretted missing what would become a multi-billion dollar opportunity. This growth phase wasn't without challenges. During a dinner with investor Howard Hartenbaum, Chesky first heard about the Samware brothers, German entrepreneurs notorious for creating copycat businesses in international markets before American companies could expand globally. This warning would prove prescient as Airbnb faced international competition from the Samware's Wimdu, forcing them to accelerate their global expansion plans. While Airbnb was scaling rapidly, Uber faced its first major regulatory challenge in October 2010 when four plainclothes enforcement officers served them with a cease and desist order. The citation threatened $5,000 per ride and 90 days in jail for each day of operation. At the heart of this conflict was Christiane Hayashi, director of taxis and accessible services at San Francisco's Metropolitan Taxi Agency. A veteran of the city's bare-knuckle politics, with a law degree from UC Hastings, Hayashi had already weathered numerous taxi industry battles. She'd attempted to reform the city's dysfunctional cab system with its 15-year waiting list for medallions and poor service outside downtown. Her efforts to mandate credit card readers in cabs had been met with fierce resistance from drivers who circled the MTA building, honking their horns in protest. When taxi drivers began complaining about Uber cab allowing limo drivers to act like taxis, Hayashi saw a clear violation. By law, only taxis could pick up street hails and use government-certified meters, while limos required pre-arranged rides. Uber had effectively erased this distinction with electronic hails and iPhone-based fare calculation. Though regulating limos was technically the state's responsibility, Hayashi found her opening. The company was calling itself Uber Cab, marketing itself as a taxi service. Kalanick's response established what would become Uber's standard playbook: comply minimally while continuing operations. They dropped Cab from their name and registered as a limo company, but otherwise changed nothing about their service. This approach, what Kalanick later called principled confrontation, would become Uber's defining strategy in regulatory battles worldwide. The company believed its service was so superior to existing transportation options that public opinion would eventually force regulators to accommodate them. This early battle revealed Travis Kalanick's combative leadership style. Though still only working at Uber part-time, he led the response to regulators with the same intensity that had defined his previous startups. This confrontational approach would help Uber grow explosively, but would eventually contribute to Kalanick's downfall when applied to internal company culture. In summer 2011, Airbnb faced its first major crisis when a host known as EJ published a blog post describing how her apartment had been ransacked, vandalized, and burglarized by an Airbnb guest. The company's initial response was defensive and tone-deaf, with Chesky and his team focused on damage control rather than empathy for the victim. Following Paul Graham's advice to fall on the sword, Chesky eventually crafted a comprehensive response. Airbnb introduced a 24-hour customer service hotline, doubled support staff, created a dedicated trust and safety department, and began developing identity verification systems. The centerpiece was the Airbnb guarantee, initially set at $50,000. Marc Andreessen suggested adding a zero to the originally planned $5,000, which would later grow to $1 million insured by Lloyd's of London. Chesky wrote a heartfelt letter to users stating, "Over the last 4 weeks, we have really screwed things up," and included his personal email address. The internet storm subsided, though behind closed doors, Airbnb reportedly entered mediation with EJ and paid her a substantial settlement sealed with an NDA. While managing this crisis, Airbnb was simultaneously battling the Samware brothers' Wimdu, which had raised $90 million and was aggressively copying Airbnb's model across Europe. Chesky refused to partner with them, telling colleagues he would rather not negotiate with a terrorist and go fight and lose than give in. Instead, he recruited Oliver Jung to lead Airbnb's international expansion. Jung rapidly opened offices in Berlin, London, Barcelona, Copenhagen, Milan, Moscow, Paris, Delhi, Sao Paulo, and more. Each new country manager received an office in a box with ping pong tables and inspirational books to maintain Airbnb's culture. Many managers emulated Chesky's approach. Moscow's Eugen Mirapolsky even lived in Airbnbs around the city, just as Chesky had done in San Francisco. The strategy worked. Despite Wimdu's year-long head start internationally, Airbnb's stronger technology and global network prevailed. By June 2012, Airbnb had booked 10 million cumulative nights, with Europe becoming its largest market and Paris its largest city. Through these crises, Chesky had truly become CEO. "This is when I became CEO in a meaningful way," he reflected. 2011 was the year I really had to become a CEO, to become a champion of Airbnb. We came out of EJ and the Samwares stronger than when we came into it. By 2012, Uber had refined its expansion playbook to a science. Each new city launch followed a similar pattern. Identify wealthy neighborhoods with poor taxi service, recruit black car drivers with guaranteed hourly minimums, generate buzz through celebrity promotions and free rides, then gradually expand outward as demand grew. Austin Geet, one of Uber's earliest employees and a recovering addict who initially struggled with imposter syndrome, became the company's expansion specialist. Her first challenge was New York City, where large livery fleets held all leverage and demanded high minimum payments. This forced Kalanick to compromise on his principles. Contrary to his combative reputation, Kalanick recognized the necessity of registering Uber as a base in New York. This required Kalanick, Camp, and investor Bill Gurley to personally visit the TLC office for fingerprinting. The team also developed the Soho strategy, targeting wealthy neighborhoods instead of spreading drivers thinly across the city, which dramatically improved service quality and driver recruitment. With New York gaining momentum, Kalanick pushed to launch in Paris during Le Web conference, despite engineering protests about the technical challenges of internationalization. Working around the clock for 3 weeks, the team somehow managed the impossible launch, impressing even skeptical investors like Chris Sacca. Uber's controversial surge pricing evolved through experimentation. After a disastrous uncapped New Year's Eve where prices spiked to 7 times normal rates, causing customer outrage, Michael Pau's methodical testing in Boston provided conclusive data showing surge pricing could increase driver availability by 70% to 80% during peak times. Despite public backlash, Kalanick never wavered once he had the math to support it. This data-driven approach characterized Kalanick's leadership. Unlike many founders who relied on intuition, Kalanick demanded evidence before making decisions. This analytical mindset helped Uber grow explosively, but sometimes blinded Kalanick to the human impact of the company's policies, a weakness that would eventually contribute to his downfall. By 2013, both Uber and Airbnb had reached a critical inflection point. Their services had become too popular to ban outright, but they operated in regulatory gray areas that threatened their existence. This forced both companies to develop sophisticated political strategies far beyond what typical startups require. When ride-sharing services like Lyft and Sidecar emerged, they created distinctive rituals to normalize the once taboo act of getting into strangers' cars. Lyft outfitted cars with pink car stashes that became instantly recognizable brand icons. Unlike Uber, which positioned itself as everyone's private driver, Lyft's vision was to replace car ownership by utilizing every car, every driver. Travis Kalanick initially dismissed these services as illegal, believing they violated California regulations requiring commercial licenses. "We try to go into a city and we try to be totally legitimately legal," he insisted on a podcast. This created a dilemma. If he launched his own unlicensed service and it was declared illegal, Uber faced severe penalties, but doing nothing risked letting competitors grow unchecked. When the California Public Utilities Commission sent cease and desist letters to Lyft and Sidecar, Lyft hired Susan Kennedy, former CPUC commissioner and Schwarzenegger's chief of staff. Kennedy persuaded CPUC President Michael Peavy to create new regulations rather than shut down the services, arguing, "You can't put the genie back in the bottle." Meanwhile, Uber's representatives lobbied for their competitors' shutdown. The CPUC ultimately reached consent decrees with the companies in January 2013, allowing them to operate with basic safety requirements. Kalanick, seeing the writing on the wall, pivoted and launched UberX as a ride-sharing service, declaring in a white paper titled Principled Innovation that Uber had chosen to compete rather than use regulation to thwart competitors. This episode crystallized what became known as Travis's Law, the belief that politicians would eventually accommodate services markedly better than alternatives, regardless of existing regulations. This principle guided Uber's aggressive expansion strategy, but also contributed to its reputation for arrogance and lawlessness. The company operated with a simple assumption. If consumers loved the service enough, politicians would eventually adapt regulations rather than face voter backlash. As Airbnb faced regulatory challenges across cities, it shifted strategy from resistance to collaboration. In Portland, the company struck a landmark deal. Hosts would pay reduced registration fees of $180 instead of $4,000, undergo safety inspections, and notify neighbors, while Airbnb would collect the 11.5% lodging tax without revealing host identities. This Shared Cities initiative represented Airbnb's new approach, offering tax collection as a carrot to cities in exchange for legalization. The strategy spread rapidly. Airbnb began collecting hotel taxes in San Francisco, even paying back taxes, and struck similar deals in Chicago, Washington, D.C., Phoenix, Philadelphia, and European cities like Amsterdam. Brian Chesky believed this approach was turning the tide, with cities developing individualized policies rather than following New York's hostile stance. However, in New York, one of Airbnb's largest markets, negotiations collapsed when the company suddenly became politically radioactive. Two powerful forces had mobilized: the hotel industry, alarmed by Airbnb's $10 billion valuation, and hotel unions, concerned about Airbnb's attempt to partner with SEIU for house cleaning services. The Attorney General's report revealed 67% of New York rentals violated the law, with 6% of hosts controlling 37% of revenue. Even in cities with shared city agreements, compliance remained minimal, with few hosts registering and Airbnb refusing to enforce registration requirements. Despite his diplomatic public persona, demonstrated during a global entrepreneurship summit in Kenya with President Obama, Chesky proved as determined a fighter as Uber's Kalanick, believing deeply in his company's mission and battling for escape velocity beyond regulatory constraints. Meanwhile, host Peter Kwan formed the Home Sharers of San Francisco to navigate the emerging legal complexities. This group, eventually 2,500 members strong, successfully lobbied to keep host identities private when San Francisco legalized short-term rentals in 2014, allowing unlimited hosted stays and 90 nights of unhosted rentals annually. This period revealed how both companies had evolved from scrappy startups to sophisticated political operations, with lobbying teams, grassroots organizing capabilities, and data-driven campaign strategies. Their approaches differed superficially, Airbnb presenting itself as collaborative, while Uber embraced confrontation, but both companies ultimately prioritized growth over strict regulatory compliance. By 2015, both Uber and Airbnb had conquered most American cities and were rapidly expanding internationally. Their global ambitions, however, faced resistance from both regulators and local competitors who understood their markets better. In China, Uber faced its most formidable opponent in Didi Dache, founded by former Alibaba salesman Cheng Wei. Despite humble beginnings, failing to sell insurance in college, and starting at Alibaba for just $225 monthly, Cheng proved to be a talented entrepreneur. He launched Didi with $100,000 from his former boss, Wang Gang, focusing on modernizing China's fragmented taxi industry. The Chinese ride-sharing landscape transformed dramatically when rival Kuaidi Dache secured funding from Alibaba in April 2013. Recognizing the need for powerful allies, Cheng Wei quickly raised $15 million from Alibaba's arch-rival Tencent. What followed was a brutal proxy war between China's tech giants, with both services burning through millions daily on driver subsidies. During one infamous 7 days, 7 nights, both services experienced technical problems, with Didi engineers working so intensely that one needed surgical removal of contact lenses. While Didi and Kuaidi battled, Uber had been quietly preparing its China strategy since 2013. Despite the graveyard of failed American tech companies in China, Kalanick was undeterred. By fall 2014, emboldened by global success, Uber introduced People's Uber in several Chinese cities, securing a crucial partnership with Baidu for funding and access to Baidu Maps. The strategy initially worked. With Didi and Kuaidi distracted by their merger, Uber gained ground, claiming 30% market share. But challenges emerged. Taxi drivers struck in multiple cities, police raided Uber offices, and the Ministry of Transport ruled against private car owners using ride-hailing apps for profit. By 2016, both companies were burning over $1 billion annually on driver and rider subsidies. After frantic fundraising on both sides, they negotiated peace. Uber agreed to exit China in exchange for a 17% stake in Didi plus a $1 billion investment. Though Kalanick had surrendered the market, the deal valued Uber's stake at $7.2 billion, an impressive return on its $2 billion investment. This global mega unicorn deathmatch revealed the limits of Uber's expansion strategy. Even with billions in funding and sophisticated technology, local knowledge and government relationships proved decisive in markets like China. The experience forced both companies to become more pragmatic about international expansion, sometimes partnering with local players rather than attempting to conquer every market directly. In January 2017, President Trump's executive order banning citizens from 7 majority Muslim countries triggered widespread protests. When the New York Taxi Workers Alliance called a strike at JFK Airport, Uber executives in Manhattan suspended surge pricing to avoid appearing exploitative but continued operating service. Despite their intentions, this decision ignited the #DeleteUber social media campaign, with hundreds of thousands of users deleting their accounts. This was just the beginning of Uber's perfect storm of crises. Former engineer Susan Fowler published an explosive blog post detailing sexual harassment and corporate dysfunction at Uber. She described being propositioned by her manager on her first day, HR dismissing her complaints, and systemic sexism throughout the company. The post went viral, forcing Kalanick to hire former Attorney General Eric Holder to investigate. The company's internal disarray stemmed from explosive growth to 15,000 employees across hundreds of cities without proper leadership infrastructure. Kalanick's entrepreneurial talents were matched by fatal flaws: resistance to hiring experienced executives, extreme competitiveness, and a belligerent management style that alienated employees, board members, and partners. Additional scandals followed. Key executives resigned, reports emerged of Kalanick and other executives visiting a Korean escort karaoke bar, and most damaging, revelations that executives had obtained and discussed the confidential medical records of a rape victim in India while entertaining conspiracy theories about competitors. After the India revelations, 6 senior executives sent a confidential letter to Uber's board demanding an independent chairman and Kalanick's temporary removal. The board reviewed Eric Holder's report and adopted 47 recommendations for company reform. Emil Michael was dismissed, and Kalanick was forced to take a leave of absence. Despite his leave, Kalanick remained deeply involved, calling into meetings, reviewing data, and making decisions. Bill Gurley of Benchmark Capital, once a vocal Colonix supporter, grew increasingly alarmed by Colonix leadership failures. A marketing survey revealed Colonix was America's most unpopular CEO. Benchmark partners decided Colonix had to go permanently and rallied other investors. On June 20, 2017, Benchmark partners confronted Colonix in Chicago with a letter demanding his resignation. Uber ultimately hired Dara Khosrowshahi from Expedia as CEO, a diplomatic, humble leader who immediately demonstrated a conciliatory approach when London revoked Uber's license. Colonix's downfall offered several lessons for upstarts. Relationships matter, ethical decision-making matters, and a little humility can go a long way. The contrast between Uber and Airbnb's trajectories is instructive. While both companies disrupted established industries and faced similar regulatory challenges, their different approaches to company culture and leadership produced divergent outcomes. Airbnb's emphasis on community and belonging created a more sustainable organization, while Uber's aggressive, always-be-hustling culture eventually imploded. The upstarts had changed the world, but one of them learned that how you win matters as much as winning itself.